Hello, lovely digital listeners. Introducing Schools to Prisons, a collaborative research project between Our American Generation and the League of Education Voters. This project is about highlighting the concerning link between our nation's prisons and public education systems, a link that turns struggling students into juvenile delinquents.
Between us, we have two nonprofits. One, a youth-driven social justice think tank. The other, a statewide advocacy organization aimed at fixing Washington's public schools. Together, these groups are exploring the role of race and wealth in our public school system and how different demographics usually end up with different outcomes. Did you know that black male students are 3 times as likely to be suspended than white male students? Why do Latino students consistently perform worse on standardized tests when we know they are just as smart? These are some of the questions this series hopes to answer.
So we began this project in hopes of building off of OAG's Crime and Community zine. We started simply by looking at the data we already knew existed. There's research out there on what many refer to as the achievement gap. In a nutshell, since No Child Left Behind was passed in 2002, schools nationwide have been required to release their test scores and graduation rates broken down by race and economic status. Now that this data is required, we have a very powerful tool for measuring public school success rates by race and by income. So when folks in the U.S. started to observe all this new data, a disturbing trend was revealed, one that many already knew from experience. Our country's public school system is serving students of color and low-income students worse than white or higher-income students.
It's important to note that many studying this topic refer to it as the achievement gap. But for the purpose of our research here, we're referring to it as an opportunity gap for several reasons. Mainly, we aim to move away from a discussion that is focused on an individual student's achievement on a test or a grade, and more towards a discussion that looks at how our schools systematically deny students opportunities for success. This redefinition also helps remind us that there are large social implications for disparities in educational attainment. It's not just a matter of missed income for an individual that doesn't graduate from high school. It's the general welfare and prosperity of our entire nation that suffers. In this first podcast of the 3-part series, we'll introduce you to the issue of Washington's opportunity gap. We've been working together, researching and interviewing for several months now, trying to answer some of the questions that are at the heart of the issue. What is the opportunity gap? What is the school-to-prison pipeline? And what causes this phenomenon?
In short, the opportunity gap is the gap in academic performance between white students and students of color, and also between wealthy students and poor students. The school-to-prison pipeline is the trend of schools pushing their bad kids out and into the juvenile justice system. But before we get into these larger questions, let us explain why we're even asking them. So Lev and OAG started to work together after some awesome reporting done by a previous research team at OAG. In that report, titled Crime and Community, youth researchers outlined current problems within our criminal justice system. Those problems are twofold. For one, the entire prison system is overcrowded, with one in every 100 Americans detained in a jail or prison at this moment. The second problem is the piece about race and privilege. So 1 in 106 whites are in custody, while 1 in 15 African Americans and 1 in 36 Hispanic Americans are behind bars. Despite this, there is tons of research that shows that whites commit crimes at the same rate as people of color. Who actually ends up serving time in prison is due in large part to over-policing of areas where people of color predominantly live and harsher prosecution and sentencing in our court systems. The United States has a long history of discrimination against people of color. Sometimes that discrimination is physically written into laws, like segregation in the Jim Crow era. Sometimes that discrimination plays out far more subtly, like who's targeted for subprime mortgages in the foreclosure scandals, or who can gain access to banks and credit card accounts. Our history books show that there was once a time when our society believed people of color were biologically less intelligent than white people. An idea known as eugenics that has long been discredited. However, many of the vestiges of eugenics still haunt us. Far too often, politicians and people in power blame social inequities on the characteristics and personality traits of individual communities or ethnic groups. This notion is scientifically unfounded and needs to be squashed. This is the reason it is so important to create a distinction between the words achievement and opportunity. It's not a matter of individuals achieving less. It is a matter of how our social systems deny opportunities to underrepresented populations. Dismal learning environments and overuse of the juvenile detention services are two examples of where we can begin the discussion. So while discrimination and race-based biases are a known and common thread in our nation's history, the enormous rate of imprisonment is not. In fact, only three White Houses ago, in the Clinton era, the United States embarked on all sorts of quote-unquote tough-on-crime politics. Outside of schools, these politics led to a major escalation in law enforcement and what is known to many as the drug war. In the context of schools, tough-on-crime meant the creation of zero-tolerance policies for drugs, alcohol, and weapons on school campuses. The outcome is over-policed public schools and tighter links between our schools and juvenile justice systems.
When I first read the Crime and Community Report, the wheels of my brain automatically started turning and connecting these two institutions, the public school system and the prison system. In particular, I kept remembering a horrifying story that circulates around the education world, that some states have estimated the number of prison cells they will need to build in the future based on their public schools' reading or test scores, from as early on as the third grade even. And then I started remembering the news story where two judges in Pennsylvania pled guilty to wire fraud and income tax fraud for accepting over $2.6 billion in kickbacks from private youth detention centers. These judges sentenced over 5,000 young offenders to private juvenile justice centers in exchange for the cash. 4,000 of these rulings have since been overturned since those two judges were removed from their jobs. So with a lot of concern but less knowledge, we set out to explore the opportunity gap and how it relates to the school-to-prison pipeline. The very first piece of information we found was disheartening, but also gave our project greater importance in our eyes. Washington is one of 9 states in this country whose opportunity gap is still growing. Students of color within our state's public school system also have disproportionately higher rates of suspension, expulsion, truancy, and dropouts. Not only does this lead to a disproportionate number of students of color falling behind in school, but big disparities in the demographics of kids sent off to juvie as well. Academically speaking, suspension is the worst thing a school could do to a student. As we could all guess, the less time you spend in the classroom with your peers learning new material and practicing skills, the less likely you are to do well in school. Imagine getting suspended, then missing a week's worth of classes and not being able to make up assignments or projects. Then imagine getting tested on that material you never learned a few weeks later. It's no wonder where the inequities in standardized tests come from.
On average, in Washington's public school system, 76% of white students graduate high school on time. In contrast, only 60% of Black, Latino, and Native Americans graduate on time. Needless to say, there's a problem here. When we look at information that tracks how school districts discipline their students, we see equally alarming data. In 2006, more than 3.3 million students were suspended or expelled, which is a ratio of about 1 in 14 young people pushed out of the public school system. In that same year, 15% of our nation's African American students were suspended, in comparison to only 5% of our nation's white students. These gaps are already egregious. As they grow, Washington digs itself deeper and deeper into a hole. A hole that unfairly privileges white folks through policy, discriminates against young folks of color, and ultimately leaves our society with alarming social inequities.
The use of the term school-to-prison pipeline has become a regular feature in the research we've been studying. The language is intentional. It suggests that there are structures and forces that push young folks in certain situations out of the public school system and directly into the custody of our prison systems. This is especially true for young students of color and especially true for students from lower economic backgrounds. The pipeline could also imply the fact that youth are almost always unaware of the full consequences of the behavior and plain don't know the juvenile detention centers what's waiting at the end of the pipeline. However, the idea of one single pipeline is limited. As we come to understand the vast differences in student experience within the school and prison systems, it becomes clear that there isn't merely one path down this pipeline. We're pretty sure a pipeline isn't even close to describing the enormous diversity of pathways a young person navigates to get their education. Guestworks Park couldn't house as many rusty pipes as we've got to describe our journeys. Some students trip and fall into a cycle of crime. Some are caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some students come from challenging home situations that make school a difficult place to stay, while others are simply unable to muster excitement for classwork. Whatever the case, public schools have shown a tendency to rely on punitive disciplinary measures to deal with students. We've even heard of teachers and administrators referring students into the juvenile court system for the purpose of getting that young person the social services classrooms aren't able to offer.
However, once that discipline starts to involve juvenile hall, we see that youth actually begin committing more and worse crimes, in a sense starting to own the label of delinquent that they were given at school. So we're asking readers and listeners to keep this in mind. The pipeline metaphor doesn't speak as much to the range of options young people have, but more to the systematic denial of an opportunity to succeed once students stray away from that track towards graduation. So before we begin to dig deep into how and why there are major disparities in academic achievement, and why we have a serious overrepresentation of students of color facing discipline, we should say a quick word about what literally happens when a student gets in trouble at school. There's an incredible variation in the way students are disciplined in and within schools, and that fact alone isn't widely recognized. Policies vary widely from student to student, school to school, district to district, and state to state. One consequence of this is that any attempt to contest a punishment is steeped in bureaucracy. Parents have to take time off work to come into schools or courtrooms to fight for their kids. Documents have to be read, understood, and filed. Legal fees and fines have to be paid for records to be cleared. Obviously, parents that are struggling to make enough money to provide for their families cannot afford all of this time off work in order to face up to this paperwork and processing. The consequence of this becomes very real when suspensions are extended simply because paperwork hasn't been done. Reviewing a typical student's path through the school-to-prison pipeline starts to illuminate where there could be opportunities for change. In Washington State alone, there are 295 school districts. This means that as a state, Washington takes 295 different approaches to discipline. The authority to pass district-wide policies regarding suspension and expulsion belongs to each school board and superintendent. They adopt a set of rules, and it becomes up to the principals to ensure that the teachers within their building are enforcing those rules. So the gamut of discipline is wide. You can receive detention, get a phone call home, receive in-school suspension. You could be sentenced with out-of-school short-term or long-term suspension, or you could even be expelled.
Discipline doesn't just lie within the purview of the school administration, though. Upon suspension or expulsion, a student can be referred directly to a juvenile detention center and prosecuted, depending on the severity of the crime. This is often perceived as the crux of the problem, the relationship between school administration and the juvenile court system. This is where the metaphor of a pipeline comes in handy again. Rarely is it the case where one student, one time, breaks a rule that lands them in jail. In reality, it is a series of events, of pushes and pulls in and out of the classroom, that lead principals and teachers to recommend a student leave the school permanently and face criminal prosecution. In the past 2 decades, we've seen a tremendous increase in adult and juvenile incarceration rates and imprisonment. One source found that between 1987 and 2007, the U.S. prison population had tripled, totaling roughly 2.3 million people behind bars. As we mentioned earlier, that led to one in every 100 Americans detained in a jail or prison. And don't forget the racial disparities in that stat earlier. One in 106 whites are in custody, while one in only 15 African Americans and one in 36 Hispanic Americans are behind bars.
So this tough-on-crime mentality permeated our schools throughout the 90s. Meanwhile, incidents like the Columbine shooting were used by administrators and politicians in order to justify a national crackdown in the public school system. What started out as a zero-tolerance policy against guns in schools turned into zero tolerance of violence, weapons, gangs, drugs, truancy, and tardiness. Some sources even cited zero-tolerance policies on vague infractions such as insubordination. The definition of a zero-tolerance policy is one that, quote, mandates predetermined consequences for rule infractions, regardless of the circumstance. Basically, no second chances. Theoretically, these policies are designed to create safe schools and safe classroom cultures. They also provide protection for teachers by setting up a seemingly objective protocol for how to deal with disruptions in the classroom. But between 1974 and 2006, the rate at which U.S. students were suspended and expelled from school nearly doubled, from 3.7% of students in 1974 to 7.1% of students in 2006. After one school district in New York adopted a zero-tolerance policy, they documented suspensions of 4 to 10-year-olds, increasing by 76%.
In some instances, we've read that students were suspended for butter knives in their lunchboxes, nail files in their backpacks, or aspirins in their pockets. Examples like these show exactly how zero-tolerance policies, which were intended to create an objective, fair, and safe environment, can and have become subjective, tedious, and unnecessarily punitive.
So we're at a point now where the tough-on-crime policies that grew out of the 90s are still in place, despite the fact that our prisons are literally getting crowded, with youth and adults alike. Punishment is still the go-to method for dealing with unruly students, despite research from the 80s showing that youth develop and respond better to nurturing than to punishment. Studies also show that young folks have a great capacity to change their behavior through rehabilitation. Sending them to prison is potentially the worst solution, because most prisons lack any resources directed towards recovery, and youth have a greater tendency to commit crimes once they've visited juvie. Also, once a young person has gone to juvie, they are likely to commit even more serious crimes upon leaving. Youth criminality has historically been blamed on poor communities or dysfunctional homes, factors that people see as ruinous to children. However, studies of developmental psychology actually show this to be an incomplete indicator of criminality, and that the mental development of a youth is affected by all mentors in her or his life, including teachers, peers, or even the police. If one is labeled as a troublemaker early on by a figure as influential as a teacher, one will be disposed to believe that they are indeed troublemakers.
Activist and scholar Angela Davis describes over-incarceration as a way of disappearing people in the false hope of disappearing the underlying social problems they represent. And in many respects, the same principles apply to adults attempting to manage their classrooms. During our research, we touched base with a youth-led nonprofit called Seattle Young People's Project. They are currently working on a campaign asking, amongst other things, for the Seattle public school system to release more data on informal types of school punishment, such as in-school suspension and detention. When we asked the middle and high school experts about contributing factors to the school-to-prison pipeline, they told us that teachers who knew how to simply pull a student aside and tell them what they did wrong were few and far between. The much more common approach was to send a disruptive student out of the class. This included, to a certain degree, a feeling of public shame for the student's misbehavior. As the Crime and Community report lies out, instead of recognizing the distinct attributes of youth, including angst, impressionability, and general confusion, prosecutors and teachers will treat juveniles like they are grown-ups or hardened criminals. Without oversimplifying a hugely complex social problem, we really believe a few simple things could help alleviate Washington's opportunity gap. Students of color are pushed out of the classroom, suspended, and truant at rates far exceeding those of their white peers. It is then a logical conclusion that the very students who are kicked out and barred from learning perform worse on tests through the K-12 system. These gaps in reading scores and test scores are one direct consequence of schools' over-dependence on zero-tolerance policies and discipline. Research also tells us that environmental factors like community and home life are not as impactful as people often estimate. We know there are schools and teachers out there already turning the opportunity gap around. Later in our podcast series, we'll go into much further detail about the practices that are helping ease the disparities in sentencing and academic achievement. With honest and transparent work around humanizing the discipline process, learning communities all over have already made progress.
Well, we hoped you all enjoyed this segment on the opportunity gap and the school-to-prison pipeline. Any follow-up questions should be posted as comments on the OAG or Soapbox blogs, and one of us will find an answer for you. In this segment, we laid down the context of the opportunity gap, but we were not able to dive all the way into the complicated questions about how race and class become tangled into all this, and about exactly how much student potential we are losing. That will be the task for the next two segments, The Price of Inequity and The New Jim Crow. Make sure to check back in every week this month for a new segment and start getting excited for the full zine that will follow this series. That's all we've got for now. From OAG and Lev, we love y'all and we'll see you next week.